Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland
on News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. Coming up on this week's episode, we're going to be speaking to Olive Heffernan, an Irish journalist. He's written a book about the high seas. And it's really fascinating because we often think very locally about planet Earth. We're very concerned about the places that are near to us, coasts and so on. But most of our planet is in the middle of nowhere, far beyond 200 kilometres from our shores. What happens there and who's looking after it? Find out in a few minutes' time. But first, we're looking back at the week's science news. We're joined by Dr. Ruth Freeman from Science Foundation Ireland and Phil Smith, our favourite TV science guy. Let's start with you, if you don't mind. First story has to do with a new study that looks at biodiversity and what sort of size of the planet we need to give back to the animals.
Yeah, and it might seem a little bit small because research coming out of Frontiers in Science has found that the targeted expansion of protected areas on land would be enough to prevent the loss of thousands of mammals, birds, amphibians and plants that are kind of the closest to disappearing. The percentage of the Earth that is about 1.2% of Earth's land, and that could save the most threatened species. Now, the study itself has identified nearly 16,825 sites around the world where prioritizing conservation would prevent extinction of these thousands of unique species. So Dr. Eric Dinerstein of the environmental organization Resolve.
And great name.
Superb name, Dinerstein. It does feel like he should have a restaurant of some kind. And the environmental organization Resolve, a well-named organization as well. He was the lead author of the study, and the team were trying to identify the world's rarest species with limited habitats, using kind of the example of the peyote cactus, which is a remaining range, only small parts of the Chinchulan desert in North America. So he was saying that most species on Earth are rare, and that meaning that the species would either have very narrow ranges that can either occur or they're low densities of both. So if you can expand some of the areas on Earth, about 38% of these areas of the 16,825 are within 1.5 miles, 2.5 kilometers of existing protective areas. So if you kind of expand some of the areas, you're going to have really quick wins, and then you can kind of go after the other ones. The most kind of significant areas that you want to look at are in the Philippines, Brazil, Indonesia, Madagascar and Colombia, where you see kind of tropical sites. More than half of the sites are in there. And considering that in 2022, the UN decided that they want to protect 30% of the planet so that these biodiversity targets could be hit, this is really kind of following on from that. Now, we're not doing a great job of it. We're only hitting about 7% of those targets so far. This kind of thing has precedence because in the US they passed acts and laws to protect these species, to protect certain species and animals. For example, the bald eagle at one stage only had like 425 mating pairs, whereas now it has 71,000. So by protecting particular areas and targeting it, you can really make a difference. It'll be costly. They're estimating between $29 to $46 billion, which is a lot of the money. But if you consider that it is estimated that you could lose $40 trillion from the world's economy by losing biodiversity, it's a small price to pay a year, $34 billion.
I mean, that, you know, if you look at global things that are going on in the world, $49 billion is really a drop in the ocean for even for some companies. The idea that you would, you know, have a significant impact on some of the world's most endangered species with just that amount of money, really, I mean, I think there's a PR campaign to try and find philanthropists to, you know, put together enough to really get going. But I suppose those protected species are often have those sort of champions being targeted already. What's really interesting about this is that this number is so low, because we often talk about, you know, giving half of the planet back to the animals to try and fix this horrible thing that we've created. And what's heartening in a way is that we don't need to do that to get a really big effect on these species. We just need to make and ring fence specific areas around specific species, and that can have a huge effect. So this is really a good news story.
Absolutely. And what it is it's signposting what we need to do. And it's just a case of, well, what do we need to do? this and let's get going on it. And I think the economic case, the environmental case, it all makes sense.
And the climate change case, because these areas, when they're wilded, capture so much carbon, and these large mammals capture so much carbon and create ecosystems that capture carbon. So it is really a no-brainer to do this.
Yeah, and a lot of these, the habitat is already there. It's already been identified. Just widening a little is not, you know, starting at the beginning of how do we figure out carbon capture. It's not an enormous task. Our second story has to do with antidepressants, Ruth. And this is quite a surprising study.
Yeah, well, it is. And I guess the reason why researchers are focusing on antidepressants is because more and more of us are taking them. In fact, there's research now which says that in high income countries, around 10% of adults are now taking antidepressants for depression. And
what?
Many people, And many people are on them for much longer than they were originally recommended for use. So, you know, ideally you'd be on them for a number of months, but many people are on them for years and years. And of course, if you're on them for years and years, they do have adverse effects potentially if you keep taking them, and it's only going in one direction. So in Ireland, for example, there was a 35% increase in taking of antidepressants between 2012 and 2022. So this is really going up very fast.
It is important to also recognize that that increase is also due to people seeking care, a greater awareness of mental health, and an acceptance that actually, if you take these medications, a lot of the time you will get better.
Absolutely. And of course, as you say, it's really important when people are prescribed these things that they do take them. But of course, one of the challenges people have in coming off them is the potential for the side effects of also coming off these drugs if you've been on them for a long time. And research previously had suggested that withdrawal symptoms happened to over 50% of patients. Now, it's looking like maybe it's not as high as that when we looked at research that came out last year. It could only be about 15% of patients that are experiencing those side effects. But nonetheless, it puts people off coming off these drugs. So this new study looks at just over 300 adults who had been taking antidepressants for over a year if it was their first episode of depression, or over 2 years if they were having recurrent depression. And they were all classified as people who were suitable to try and come off the drugs. So their doctor had said it was safe for them to come off the medication. And they split the group into two, and it was a double-blind study for the purpose of the analysis. And one half of the group just got some support on a telephone or internet helpline, which was sort of GP-led. And they didn't find a huge difference in terms of those that successfully came off the antidepressants. So it was slightly more for those who had the support, 45.5% came off it versus only 41.9% without the support. But the difference was for those who came off the antidepressants and who had this relatively simple intervention, there was better scores in terms of their well-being and their mental health. And those side effects that other people experience, like anxiety, fatigue, they had much less when they had that little support. And even though the numbers seem quite low, when you look at the scale of this issue, the researchers say this small and relatively cheap intervention actually makes a huge difference to people's well-being as they come off these drugs. And this research was done in the UK, and they're actually calling for the establishment of a national helpline, which, you know, just to support people coming off antidepressants, because if they get that little bit of support, it makes a difference to their well-being as they come off these drugs.
Yeah, and I remember we were talking about this in the radio a few years back, people concerned not just about physical side effects, but also, risk of suicide and all these other things that they were very concerned about what would happen if they came off these, SSRIs and other antidepressants. This sounds like it could have a huge impact. And, essentially, if you have treated the depression, if you've completed the course, it is important that you try to get off if you can, and it's safe to do so. It sounds like a great intervention. Our third story has to do, Philip, with epilepsy. And this is a really interesting case.
Yeah, epilepsy is something that happens when abnormal electrical brain activity, or kind of can be known as a seizure. You think of it kind of like a storm inside of your head when it's kind of firing. And because the brain controls so much, any kind of storm like that can cause upheaval and different things can go wrong. So you can have unusual behaviors, feelings, sometimes a loss of awareness. There's many different causes of epilepsy, including an imbalance of nerve signaling chemicals called neurotransmitters, different brain damage or illnesses, or combinations of these. But in the majority of cases, there's no detectable cause for epilepsy. Now, in something that's happened in the UK, a UK boy has been given a brain implant fitted to control epilepsy seizures in what is considered a world first. Now, having done some research on this, there are other brain implants that have happened before to other people in the States. But what this particular stimulus is doing, it is a neurostimulator that sits under the skull of Oren Nolson's head and sends a constant electrical signal into the brain, reducing his daytime seizures by 80%. Now, this is particularly significant for this young boy because he was having up to hundreds of seizures a day, some going on during the night where he would lose consciousness, where he would need to be resuscitated. So even thoughts of going for a walk, playing any kind of game or something, or being unsupervised was impossible potentially for this 13-year-old boy. So what you would have seen previously was something called an ORNS system, which basically what they did in the States is that one that you would have it would look for a different kind of chemical or electrical response in the brain and then deliver a stimulus or an electrical stimulus to cut off the seizure. In this case, what they're doing is they have a constant signal that kind of blocks out the background noise. In physics, you might think of it, or electrical, as a kind of a bandpass filter so that certain levels of noise don't get through. Or if you've ADHD, kind of think of the drugs that you give you up to a certain level that only the strongest signals might get through. So it's kind of trying to dampen things down. And Martin Tisdale, who we call Mr. Martin Tisdale because he's a surgeon, not we don't call him doctor because I've learned that over the last while in Great Ormond Street Hospital, has said that for Oren and his family, epilepsy completely changed their lives. And now you're going to be able to see him riding a horse, getting independence, and that is absolutely astounding. And for the amount of patients that have this, a neurostimulator, it's a 3.5 centimeter square and it's about 0.6 of a centimeter thick, that's placed in the gap in Oren's skull where the bone was just removed a little bit, anchored to the screw, giving these constant signals, and it can be recharged, unlike the ORNS systems, we're using a pair of headphones remotely. So it's a jump in technology, but it's also the assistive technology in it. You don't have to do an operation every 3 years to replace it. It's constant. And this is a particularly acute condition that really has a massive change in someone's life. And now Oren can go out and try and play football or maybe just sleep soundly. And this is one of the most wonderful things to happen. Science having a massive impact in someone's life specifically.
That's a really lovely story. And anyone who knows someone who lives with that sort of chronic epilepsy, they know exactly how difficult it is, what a struggle it is for those who are trying to deal with it. Fantastic story. Thanks, Phil. Our final story has to do with butterflies, Ruth.
It does. It's sort of detective work and butterflies, because in 2013, researchers found painted lady butterflies on the Atlantic beaches of French Guiana. And French Guiana is a country which is just north of Brazil in South America. Now, painted lady butterflies, we know them very well. They're kind of an orange and brown butterfly that we get in Ireland in the summer, but they are not native to French Guiana. And researchers for 10 years have been trying to work out how those butterflies got there, and they finally seem to have cracked it. So they sort of attacked the problem from a number of different directions. So the first thing they did was they looked at the wind patterns that were happening around October 2013 when these butterflies were found. And they did find that there was exceptionally favorable conditions that could potentially have helped to blow these butterflies across from Western Africa or Western Europe to South America. But this is a very, very long way. This is over 4,500 kilometers. And remember, these butterflies only live maybe 4 to 5 weeks. So, you know, you really have to think about the distances and the speed here. So they weren't convinced. So then they went and sequenced the genomes of these butterflies, and they found that their closest relations were indeed in Africa and Europe, sort of reinforcing this hypothesis that it was an ocean journey. But they went even deeper. They then managed to find tiny bits of pollen grains that were on these butterflies. And there was lots of different plant species that they could identify, but there was two particularly that only grow in tropical Africa. So it's like the last place these butterflies landed before they left was Africa. What? But they went even further. They were able to pick up, there's a technique where you can look at different isotopes that come on butterflies' wings. So this was developed about 5 years ago. They were able to analyze hydrogen levels and strontium levels on the butterflies. And this is a fingerprint of what was being eaten when the butterfly was born, the first meal. And they found that these butterflies were born in Europe. And in fact, some of them could even have been born here in Ireland, which is quite incredible. So putting all of this together, they now have, you know, the picture is that these butterflies were born in Europe, maybe in the UK, Ireland. They do migrate. So these butterflies normally migrate between Africa and the Arctic, but they do that over about six generations. So this one generation must have caught a favorable wind down to West Africa, where they ate a good meal of nectar. And then it probably only took them 5 to 8 days to cross the whole Atlantic in this mega journey, which is the longest journey that's ever been recorded for an insect.
Thousands of kilometers. Over the course of just a few days, like that's incredible.
It is. And most butterfly species, we do see these very long migrations in monarch butterflies and other butterflies. But as I said, they do those in generations. So one butterfly doesn't complete the single migration. But here it seems like they are using this Saharan air layer, which is a high air route. I mean, Saharan dust does get blown to the Amazon. But what they're saying is really we're only still scratching the surface of understanding how insects play a role on our whole planet and how they interact with all of the different ecosystems around the globe. So isn't it wonderful that we're still discovering this in 2024?
Yeah, we actually had a guy called David Barry on the program, and he was talking about some of these extraordinary migrations. It's a really good book, actually. It's called Incredible Journeys, if you're interested in the summer read. That's it from our news panel. Dr. Ruth Freeman from Science Foundation Ireland and science guy Phil Smith, thanks for your time. Now, if you're anything like me, when you hear the term the high seas, your mind probably goes immediately to the image of a pirate ship and pirates on shoulders and shiver me timbers and all that sort of stuff. But what actually is the high seas? And what goes on out there? Well, Olive Heffernan is a science journalist and author of The High Seas, Ambition, Power and Greed on the Unclaimed Ocean. She joins me now. This is a funny subject, Olive, because it's something I've never thought about. And it's not something that's, you know, really obscure, like it's a huge part of our planet. But I haven't really thought of international waters. So just wouldn't mind starting off just defining what are we talking about when we say the high seas? Because it's actually there's a definition.
Absolutely, yeah. So I think most of it, you know, they think about it in a sort of a metaphorical sense, you know, whether it's a forbidding environment or a wild west of our planet. Yeah. But it is a legal definition. And it basically refers to those waters that are beyond national borders. So if you think about a coastal nation like Ireland, we have territorial seas and they extend 12 nautical miles from shore. So we have complete jurisdiction over the resources and the space in that area.
You're essentially crossing the border once you go into that.
Yeah. So then you have, after that, you have an exclusive economic zone and we have first dibs on all the resources in that area. So whether it's the fish or the minerals, but we don't have sovereignty over the space. Other nations can come and go from that space as they please, right? Or they can pass the airspace overhead. When you get out beyond the exclusive economic zone at 200 nautical miles from shore, that's the high seas. It covers half the surface of our planet and 2/3 of the global ocean. So if you were to just take a globe, it's those big patches of blue. We're talking about the major ocean basins and also, interestingly, the Mediterranean Sea. So, yeah, it's those major bits of blue. And, you know, it's interesting to think that it's also 95% of the available living space on Earth. Because, like, if you just thought about the planet in volumetric terms, because these waters are so deep, they're on average 4,000 metres deep. This is just a massive portion of our planet.
Just before we go into the high seas, the jurisdictional area, well, I mean, obviously you share that with other countries a lot of the time. You know, Europe, Spain would share some with Portugal, for example. How do they figure that out?
Yeah, so that's interesting. I mean, in the Mediterranean, for example, The reason high seas exist in the Mediterranean is because when the UN Law of the Sea came into force in 1994, it allowed nations to claim territorial seas and then an exclusive economic zone. But in certain areas, there were overlapping claims because there just wasn't enough space. And so they either had to come to an agreement or they decided to forgo those claims. Like in the Mediterranean, they decided to just forgo claiming an exclusive economic zone, and they just kind of pushed it into the long grass.
Right.
So those waters are still high seas.
There's an interesting origin for this idea of high seas, isn't there?
There is. And I write about that in the book. So, you know, it actually all originated during a battle at sea back in 1603. You know, at the time, if you think about the ocean, there were these major seafaring nations like particularly Portugal, Spain, and the Dutch wanted to sort of grab some of that for themselves. So there was an incident on the high seas where these Dutch Admiralty sailors basically captured and ransacked a Portuguese carrack, which was one of these big merchant ships coming back from the Far East and laden with all sorts of, you know, incredible wares and slaves and other things. But it all became this big legal battle, and this incredibly clever legal jurist from Holland argued that the free seas, the high seas should be the free seas. They should be open to all nations to navigate and to exploit. And what's interesting is, you know, at the time, basically everyone thought that the high seas, that like the ocean, it was so vast that it was sort of unknowable and that it was just
endless.
Inexhaustible well, absolutely inexhaustible. Of course, we know now that neither is true.
Yeah. So let's talk about what goes on there then, because this is what I found very interesting. And again, it's just not something I thought about. So are there literally no laws that govern what happens in the high seas, or is that a myth?
That is a bit of a myth. That's not lawless. So There's basically a menagerie of sort of rules and codes of conduct and bodies. For example, like the IMO, the International Maritime Organization, oversees shipping. Other organizations.
So what would they do? Like, what would they oversee? Like, what would they make sure doesn't happen?
Well, they might, you know, have certain rules about pollution. Where the shipping lanes are, what areas you can, you know, travel through, that sort of thing, right? But none of them have conservation at the kind of heart of their agenda. So I think in the absence of that rule, it's basically become, you know, in effect, a free-for-all. And that's for several reasons.
When you say free-for-all, what's happening?
Well, you know, there's just vast over-exploitation. And it's interesting that, you know, even if you think about pollution, some entire industries get a free pass on dumping on the high seas. And that was something I hadn't appreciated before writing this book. I mean, just to give you one sort of quirky example, the space industry is a good example. So there's a place in the ocean called Point Nemo, and technically it is the furthest part of the ocean from land, but it's also now the world's largest spacecraft cemetery, and it's where the International Space Station will be sent to die at the end of its useful life.
What?
Yeah, it's amazing. So, and there's a precedent for this, like Mir, which was the Russian Soviet space station, that now lives at the bottom of the Pacific Ocean. So I think since...
It's like a nuclear waste dump, but
for space
waste.
Yeah, because when you think about it, say you have satellites or even, you know, rockets or space stations in orbit, they need to decommission at some point. And there's really only two options. You either send them into a higher orbit or you bring them back to Earth. And that's called a controlled re-entry. It's amazing. One happens every single day of the week now. Most of them are small satellites, so they burn up on re-entry. But about once a week, something larger makes its way through, like maybe the upper stage of a rocket, and it's sent to Point Nemo. Which is this furthest point in the ocean from land. And that's for safety reasons, right? Because you don't want it to crash on somebody's house or on their head. So if you send it there, it's kind of within the safety limits for the industry, but no one's taking any account of what happens. You know, maybe it's bringing new life forms to the deep sea. Maybe it's bringing toxic waste.
No one sent a submersible down there, because that seems like the most incredible opportunity, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Okay, so the space industry gets a bit of a pass with this one small spot, but what else is happening? Because you hear and read these stories of, you know, running out of fish, you know, fewer species being spotted, the size of fish really reducing over time. Is that happening on the high seas just as much as it's happening on these, you know, jurisdictional waters and beyond?
Yeah. So the story on the high seas is that Right now, there is a very sizable distant water fishing fleet, mostly made up of boats from five nations. So China, Taiwan, Korea, Japan and Spain, really dominated by Chinese vessels, though. So sizable fleet, and it's mostly unregulated. So, you know, in theory, there are 17 organizations that sort of manage fishing on the high seas, but they actually only manage 5% of the species of fish that spend any portion of their life out there. So right. You've got 95% of species totally unmanaged. And then on top of that, you've just got vast portions of the ocean that are unmanaged. So, you know, these bodies, they kind of cover small areas of the high seas or certain species, but there's huge areas that have no regulations. And, you know, also when you think about it, it's the place in our planet, like the part of our planet that is, it's really remote and it's like least scrutinized.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of rule flouting out there, even of the rules that do exist. So, for example, you know, one way of knowing this is that at any point in time, about 20% of this high seas fishing fleet is off the radar. That means that those vessels have turned off their modes of communication that they would use to relay their position to one another, but which can also be used to detect them from space using satellites.
Right.
So going off the radar is usually a sign that they are purposefully evading detection.
Right.
And that they're involved in illegal activities. And there's all sorts of illegal activities that happen out there. And
like, I think like people, what?
Well, it's amazing. There's something called pirate fishing, and that kind of covers a whole vast remit of things like maybe poaching from a marine reserve or targeting high-value endangered species or just mismarking the catch, you know, underreporting your catch.
Right, right, right.
But there's also much more nefarious things that happen offshore. A huge use of slavery as crew on these vessels.
Really?
And also a lot of convergence crimes. So it basically is an inroad into far more serious criminal activities like human trafficking, drug trafficking, tax evasion, forgery. Like in many cases, the fishing industry out there is used as a legitimate front for these transnational organized criminal gangs. And the UN Office of Drugs and Crime have said this is a hotspot of criminal activity in the world
It would make sense.
It makes sense,
But, you know, when we talk about the worst parts of commercial fishing, you know, trawling the bottom of the ocean, you know, just basically scraping up whatever's there, despite the fact there may be corals and so on, that's not happening on high seas. Is it because, you know, the very nature of them being 200 nautical miles from land means that they must be very deep. So there's no, that sort of thing isn't happening. But it, Are they using other methods to overfish, and how do they do that?
Absolutely. So I think, you know, one of the methods that's most common out there is long lining for species such as tuna. And the problem there is there's so much bycatch associated with it.
What's long lining again?
It's, you know, casting these long lines that are baited with barbed hooks at intervals.
Right, okay. So basically a big, an enormously long sort of hook with fishing line. With
So the bycatch from that fishery is enormous. And in spite of efforts to reduce it, really, it hasn't been reduced at all. So we're talking about, you know, something like 100,000 seabirds, such as albatross, die every year as a result of longlining. And if you look at just even sharks and rays in the global ocean, since the, I think, 1950s, they have basically been depleted by about 71% in terms of their global populations, mostly as a result of bycatch. Also, leatherback turtles in the Pacific Ocean, I think their population has declined by 93%, mostly as a result of bycatch. So, you know, and it's a shame because actually, you know, there's a lot of research into how that could be reduced, but it's yet to be implemented.
There are organizations who are also trying to extend their ownership of the high seas by sort of, you call it blue acceleration.
Oh, yeah. Let me tell you about the blue acceleration. So that's interesting. I mean, I think one of the reasons I wrote this book was because I really feel that we're at this critical juncture in relation to this part of the planet. So, you know, since the 1950s, we've undergone something called the Great Acceleration. And what that means is that the human population has trebled. And with that, we have seen a huge uptick in our use of finite resources, not just fossil fuels, but things like wood, water, fish, you know, both on land and in coastal waters. And that's had all sorts of impacts on our planet. For example, you know, warming, ocean acidification, loss of biodiversity, loss of habitat. Now we're at a point called the Blue Acceleration, which is where we're looking to the ocean. And it's not just that the scale and the pace of our use of ocean resources out there on the high seas is ramping up, but it's massively diversifying. So people are thinking of all sorts of agendas for how we might use this space and its resources and bringing things to the high seas that we've just never seen out there before. A pretty good example is deep sea mining.
Yeah. And so are we finding that the international waters are actually shrinking? Or not really by much, considering how enormous they are?
Well, I think that's a good question. You know, there's certain places where there are spatial claims by nations. The Arctic is a great example. So as the sea ice is melting, the nation states that surround the Arctic are all thinking about how they can lay claim to that and actually, you know, claim the seabed as their own, in which case, you know, they would own those mineral resources and everything on the seabed. But, you know, what's fascinating is that in recent years, China has actually declared itself as a near Arctic state. I mean, Shanghai is 6,000 kilometers from the North Pole. This is total branding. But, you know, it basically is sending out a message to the world. It has set its sights on the high seas of the North.
Right.
And it is planning to forge a new shipping route through that area once the sea ice melts. Very strategic, very interesting.
Oh, once the sea ice melts.
Yeah. So right. Once the sea ice melts, this will be open season for a new shipping route that will basically supplant the Suez Canal. That's its plan in the long run. So stories that I tell, that it's like, you know, are we just looking to this unclaimed half of our planet and thinking about, you know, people are just thinking about how they might use it and claim those resources and that space. And I wanted to tell those stories, but I also wanted to give people a sense of awe and wonder at how amazing this place is and all of the incredible creatures and ecosystems out there that most of us have just never even heard of.
No, and I guess in many ways we sort of think of the high seas in a way that we think about space. We just think of it as a sort of a lack of something rather than something because we live on land.
Yeah, and you know, I think it really amuses me. We're far more likely to have a conversation about mining the moon or decamping to Mars than talking about this half of the planet. You know, when I started writing this book, most people were like, what are the high seas? Where are they? And yet everyone's familiar with these conversations about how we might sort of inhabit space in the future.
Yeah.
It's bizarre.
What could we do about it? I mean, the High Seas Treaty is obviously something that people are talking about. What exactly is that and what might it protect? I mean, realistically, if China wants to send, you know, ships into the high seas and exploit those resources, it's going to be very difficult to monitor or stop that. What is the High Seas Treaty about?
Well, the High Seas Treaty, I mean, I think it's probably the most important piece of ocean conservation legislation ever passed. Took 20 years of back and forth to get it through, but it was agreed by the UN in March of 2023. And essentially, it provides nations with a sort of a legal instrument to create marine protected areas in international waters. So right now, there's no way of doing that. And only 1% of the high seas is off limits to extractive industry.
Wow.
So it's the first time that this has been possible. And, you know, it's interesting because one part of the agreement basically says that nations can create these protected areas by majority agreement rather than by consensus. So if China didn't agree, they could still go ahead and create one of these sanctuaries on the high seas. But, you know, in terms of how it would be policed, I think what's really interesting is this growth of ocean surveillance technology. Mm. That's only happened in the last decade.
Yeah.
There are organizations, one of them is called Global Fishing Watch, and I went to Panama to meet them. So that's one of the stories I tell in the book, that they are using satellites to basically monitor the high seas fishing fleet. And they've had loads, there's been loads of success stories.
Yeah, and I think I was at the launch of one of the satellites that actually does that, on the Copernicus project. Some of those satellites are monitoring constantly over the ocean. The book is called The High Seas, Ambition, Power and Greed on the Unclaimed Ocean. A lot of the negative stuff has been talked about in the press, but actually there's lots of really interesting stories and some positivity there and some wonder, as you say. It's called The High Seas, Ambition, Power and Greed on the Unclaimed Ocean. Olive Heffernan, thanks for your time.
Thank you. Delighted.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland.
Sundays from midday on News Talk.